Welcome to the 103rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 49 years since Hampshire gave up on their county championship game against Glamorgan in Bournemouth. It was raining, there wasn't long left of the game scheduled to play, so they went home. Except it wasn't over. The rain stopped, Glamorgan came out and were awarded the match by the umpire. The MCC rather generously overturned the result afterwards, saying there had been a misunderstanding. Welcome to the podcast that knows you can never trust the British weather and the podcast that would never give up on a day's cricket.
And at least we turn up. Sometimes that's all you can ask. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about the recently departed umpire, Don Oslier. We're going to be talking about the Football World Cup as well and sort of what that means for cricket. I'm going to be taking us through the history of ball tampering, going back actually about 100 years or so. And we are going to be reviewing Connie by Harry Pearson, a biography of Lord Leary Constantine. So Don Oslier, tell us about him, Andy.
So his obituaries made quite extraordinary reading. He is probably most famous for his very determined stance on ball tampering. But I think I was taken in by the broader details of his extraordinary life story. He worked at Grimsby Fish Market and never played the game professionally, which is quite unusual, actually, for an umpire who goes on to umpire at that level, especially at that time in the 80s. He made his way up sort of the old-fashioned way, you know, diligent study of the laws of the game, combined with lots and lots of umpiring at local level. I also loved his own one-man protest in the face of the changes in limited overs cricket. So when asked to wear a bright blue coat and baseball cap, he came out at Leicestershire carrying a crate of milk bottles and shouting Milko at the crowd, which apparently went down very poorly with the authorities, but very well with everyone present. The final detail that I love very much is a romantic one, which is how he met his wife. So he went into the pharmacist looking for something for his sore shins. She gave him a very expensive cream, and it was love at first sight.
There we go. That's a dating tip. If ever you heard one, right here on Reverse Threat Radio. excuse me. What I find really impressive about him as a man is the fact that he kept his sense of humour and his love of the game, despite having a career that was in some senses a little bit checkered. He only ever ended up standing in 5 test matches. You mentioned his ongoing fight against ball tampering, and in that Pakistan series in the 1980s, there's a suggestion that he was actually sacked by the ECB from umpiring in test during that series because he was so, you know, forcibly pushing the case that there was evidence that ball tampering was going on. But the fact that he carried on with that sense of humour, I think, is a really impressive thing.
Yes, and I think there's certainly a feeling that his career was cut short. Ian Botham, interestingly, was a very strong advocate for him, saying he was a very good umpire and felt he was unfairly treated. It is worth saying that though his test career as a test umpire was short, he did get to manage a couple of series in that amazing Botham's Ashes series. So it was maybe quality rather than quantity. Now, you are committing what is generally seen as a minor act of sacrilege on this podcast by dedicating your item to football. Explain yourself.
Well, yeah, we range across quite a broad swathe of topics, but I think this may even be the first time that we've ever talked about football on the podcast. We've talked about boxing quite a lot and other sports, but anyway, here we go. So I'm not a football fan, I'll start off by saying that, and the Football World Cup, I kind of hadn't even realised that it was happening until the other day. I was reading an article by Simon Cooper, who's a sports writer in the Financial Times, about the forthcoming World Cup. Now, he's an absolute football tragic, as they'd be called in this part of the world. The article is quite interesting because he says, I'm going off to the World Cup, but actually it's going to be awful in many ways because World Cups always are really bad. And he'd done an interview with the Belgian coach where the Belgian coach was reflecting on the fact that club sides have a huge amount of time in football playing together. So you have about 60 preseason training sessions and then you play 38 games together. So there's a lot of time for a team to gel. Whereas national sides are thrown together, they've got a couple of weeks and sure, they're good players. But as a side, they don't have that opportunity to develop. And so Cooper's kind of takeout from this is that World Cups aren't actually about good football, that they derive their status because they matter, because at the end you get, you know, crowned world champion. And so that's why people get so kind of invested in it, which I thought was just an interesting thought, not least because in cricket we have, I suppose, at the moment, and certainly in the past, almost exactly the reverse situation, where players' primary allegiance isn't to their club, it's to their country. And, you know, that has some ramifications for club cricket, but it does mean that at the top level in cricket, actually the best sides in the world are national sides, whereas in football, the best sides in the world, I think it's probably fair to say, are club sides. And it's something that's obviously going to be changing in the game as particularly franchise cricket becomes more successful. We saw this with Chris Gayle, who obviously decided not to play for the West Indies so that he could go off and fulfill his dreams in the 2020. And it'll be interesting as cricket kind of makes that transition away from the national towards the club and the franchise to see how that balance lies in terms of the quality of the game.
One part of your comparison is when you talk about the idea of gelling. Now, I think one of the interesting things about a cricket team is I don't think any of us would deny that you do need a degree of gelling, you need a degree of team spirit, but perhaps not quite as much as in football. I mean, you can throw together an average group of footballers, and sometimes if they gel, you can actually create quite a good side. In cricket, actually, you seem to be able to, with quite a few of these franchise teams, throw players together and they can make it work in quite a short time.
I suppose it's individual performances really that cricket depends on in a way. You know, if you're a brilliant batsman and go out and score a double century and everyone else fails, then you're doing fine. Yeah. But in football, if you're a brilliant player surrounded by, you know, less brilliant players, you're not going to get on as well.
From the archives, now we have just come out of one ball tampering controversy where Australian sandpaper has been at the forefront of everyone's minds, and we appear to be heading into another with events in the West Indies and Sri Lanka, this time the accused. Toby is going to set the broader scene on this and look back on the history of how cricketers have looked to change the state of the ball.
Now, the first point here is that when you actually look at the documented history of ball tampering, it really goes back to, basically back to Michael Atherton and the dirt in the pocket that he used to dry his hand or not. But it's very difficult to actually find specific references to times that there was ball tampering before that in the game, and certainly in the earlier part of the 20th century, which is interesting because ball tampering has been around for as long as the game has been around. It's just that it never caused this same level of scandal. So in the early days of the game, working on the ball was accepted as a fundamental part of cricket. A lot of this had to do with the fact that when you played on uncovered wickets, there were bits of grass and mud, particularly when they were a bit wet, that used to stick to the game. And so you had to stick to the ball, so you had to routinely clean the ball. And cleaning the seam, which is now seen as a massive sin, was something that just happened all the time. So if you go back to the 1990s, Sachin Tendulkar was accused of ball tampering because he was actually just removing a bit of grass from the seam. There was a huge furore about it. Actually, removing grass from the seam is something that had happened for decades before that, and no one had just been interested.
The interesting thing about this is that most of us who play at club cricket and are still used to playing on pitches that, even when covered, may not be quite as reliable as, you know, top pitches, are used to that kind of looking after the ball. I mean, you get sort of mud on it, don't you, and things like this. And, you know, and you're quite right that actually cleaning it isn't so much it's a question of good housekeeping, really. You know, the poor bowler is going to struggle to deliver this thing if it's got chunks of mud on the seam.
Absolutely. And I think there's also a question between why cricketing regulations now completely allow and encourage what are seen as improvements to the ball in terms of shining it, but are so against other, you know, ways of handling the ball and treating the ball in terms of, you know, working on the seam or something like that, which is something that we'll come back to. One of the other big developments that actually affected the way that cricketers saw the ball was Brill Cream. And Brill Cream being the big fashion thing that came in around the Second World War, and you know, film stars all had it in their hair, and as cricketers became more like film stars, they then had it in their hair as well, and it became, you know, realized to be something that you could use to work on the ball. And when this started off, it was seen as being completely kosher. There's actually one incident where a bowler in a test match shouted to the slip cordon. You know, he was standing next to the umpire at the bowler's end. He shouted to the slip cordon to ask them to rub the broil cream better into the ball because it was getting a bit too slippery. I mean, that was the extent to which this was just seen as being absolutely par for the course.
Now to just to understand this was, you would have broil cream in your hair, and you would then run your hand through your hair, and then this wouldn't be first slip sitting there with a pot of brill cream.
No, it wouldn't be first slip. I think this is why it was seen so much as being a part of the, as just a natural part of the game, because it was just what people had in their hair. Inevitably, when you then sweat, it then becomes part of the sweat on your brow. Interestingly, there was an incident in 1977 when the England left-armer John Lever was playing against India at Chennai in a test match. And he had this very curious thing on his head. If you look at the photo of it, it just looks ridiculous, frankly. He had this band of gauze smeared with petroleum that he taped across his forehead just over his eyebrows. It looks like, I mean, I don't know what it looks like, where he got the idea from, I do not know. The idea was that it would stop sweat from running from his forehead down into his eyes. What wiping his brow would have, you know, why he didn't swipe his brow, I don't know. He took 10 wickets in that match, and the ball was swinging all over the place, and there was a suggestion that he had been smearing the grease from his forehead, where the, you know, his sweat had mixed with the petroleum in this gauze band. He'd been smearing that onto the ball and getting extra swing because of that. Now what's interesting here, so this is in 1977. So by this time, there were greater sensitivities around ball tampering, as we now call it. He denied that he'd been doing this. John Lever denied it. But the reason that it went away is because no one could prove anything, because there was no TV footage and no ability to have endless replays, which is one of the things that I think really creates our fixation with this now, is that you can get those pictures close up HD of people doing these things. Whereas in the past, because fundamentally working on the ball is quite a solitary thing, you could just get up to whatever you were going to get up to. And it was actually very hard for people to prove it, and so everyone sort of turned a blind eye a little bit.
I think this was one of the extraordinary things, and I don't really want to delve back into it because more than enough's been said, but of the recent Australian controversy, was there was a sense of naivety that you believed you could get away with it. You know, I think you would imagine now that most players are operating in a situation where they're just used to that scrutiny. They know that there will be a million slow motion replays of everything they do out there. So I think that was one of the things that almost shocked us all about it, was the idea that you thought you could get away with it in those circumstances.
There's another quite interesting anecdote from a long time ago, back in 1921, when JWHT Douglas, what a remarkable set of initials that is, you don't make them like that anymore. He was the England captain in Australia in an Ashes test. And he was, he said to Arthur Mailey during the game, the Australian spinner, that he would report Mailey to the officials for using resin in his hand to grip the ball, to better grip the ball as a spinner, which is something that Douglas thought that he'd seen Mailey do. Mailey then said in retort that he had seen Douglas using his thumbnail to pick the seam of the ball when England were bowling. And so they both sort of decided that they should just not escalate this any further. So it really was something that just the players sort of sorted out between themselves. And there was a bit of a sense of a sort of gentleman's code about these sorts of things. In terms of the gentleman's code, another interesting aspect here is when you think about back in the earlier days of cricket, the divide between amateurs and professionals, and often amateurs would be batsmen and professionals would be bowlers. And there was this view that professionals being, you know, essentially people who weren't part of the aristocracy, sort of would win at all costs and didn't have the same kind of moral code. And so bowlers doing things to the ball that may have been seen to be slightly against the spirit were actually kind of let go. Whereas for batsmen, you had to be absolutely rigid in applying some kind of ethical code. So actually, ball tampering used to be seen as sort of better, or at least is less worse than not walking if you'd hit the ball or something like that and the umpire didn't give you out. So this kind of moral standard we have now, which is completely the reverse, where actually a batsman gets less flack for not walking than someone does for tampering with the ball, is something that's actually quite new as well.
Well, one thing that's not clear even now is that the level of outrage around tampering that exists now, to what extent that is coming from within the game or outside it. So it was very interesting hearing Andrew Flintoff interviewed around the Australian ball tampering, and he was quite level-headed around the whole thing, and he was very honest around the extent to which his England team had been involved in things that were quite close to the line. So people sucking on mints in the slips, sun cream on the ball, for example, is one he talked about, which falls a bit into the Brill cream category as well. And it was interesting that actually from a player's point of view, he was quite obviously disappointed in what Australia had done, but could sort of see the areas of grey. The real level of vitriol and outrage over it has probably been driven mostly from outside the game, actually, rather than from inside it.
To the review, and for this episode, we have been reading Connie, The Marvellous Life of Leary Constantine by Harry Pearson. And the book won the Cricket Book of the Year. It was published just last year, so hot off the press. And as the title would suggest, it's a biography of the West Indian Trinidadian cricketer Leary Constantine, who was born in 1901, and it follows his life and his career all the way through to the point at the end of the book when he becomes installed as a peer of the realm in the House of Lords in London. And it's a remarkable story. What's interesting is that it talks about cricket, but it also talks about the huge political significance of Constantine's life. And I just to kick off, Andy, where did you find the greatest interest? Was it in Constantine as a man or Constantine as a cricketer?
I think for me personally, my greatest interest was in that period in the Northern League. So I guess it was him as a cricketer, but it was that kind of culture. I was going to say culture clash, but it isn't really a clash. It was, you know, West Indies meets Nelson, these Lancashire towns. And I think that fascinating way in which, in many ways, these quite traditional northern communities welcomed Constantine, and then, of course, later on, many other West Indian superstars. And I think that kind of meeting was for me the greatest source of fascination. And the way Constantine became not just a sort of cricketing hero, but a symbol of much more than that. And the way the affinity worked both ways, you know, he was loved, but he also developed a huge affection for Nelson and that entire area.
There's the wonderful moment at the end of the book when he does get a peerage, and he is the first black peer in the UK. And there's a headline of the Nelson Times or whatever the newspaper in Nelson is called, that says "local boy gone good," which, to think that, you know, he didn't go there until he was in his late 20s, and that he was felt pretty distant from there when he first arrived, actually is an amazing sign of the extent to which they kind of took him as one of their own. And certainly the way that the story of his life plays out, when you actually take it as a totality, which I think is a real strength of this book, is, and Harry Pearson reflects on this at the end, is an amazing indication of a shift in history. Essentially, he lived throughout the 20th century, and the shift in history, not only in terms of the West Indian cricket team and what that became, but also in terms of the history of the West Indies as a colonial nation, and also of the place fundamentally of black people within the UK as well. It's a remarkable story on that front.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of race is obviously central throughout the book, and there are some very grim stories in terms of run-ins with cricketers who are effectively racist, or with authorities who, you know, continue to keep teams and players very separate. Mm. But for all of that, I think the overwhelming story is when he goes to Nelson and he talks about the fact that for all the difficulties that adapting to living in a place like that involved. He talks about how the many, many, I think he describes them as the thousands of acts of warmth and generosity outweigh everything else. And I think this is one of the things here where you see the personal and the society almost moving faster than the politics. You know, this was a time where politically we still had a long way to catch up in terms of equality. But in a place like Nelson, the way people acted actually was a long way beyond that.
Mm. I mean, one of the sort of elephants in the room here is that for someone who had such a huge impact, actually, as a cricketer, his record is not impressive. And actually, interestingly, it's on page 3 of the book, at the very beginning of the book, that Pearson kind of fesses up to this. And so Constantine's test record is that he took 58 wickets at 30 runs, and he had a batting average of 19, and he never made a test century. So actually, it's not hugely impressive in terms of his figures, but his impact was huge. And one of the things that really comes across, particularly when he goes to Nelson and plays in the Lancashire League, is the way that he was really he was a crowd pleaser. People loved him. He had a character and an approach and a kind of sense of charisma that made people love him, but also, more importantly, I think actually changed the way that, you know, cricket was seen and that black people were seen within the game, within the UK as well.
I think the book pays tribute to what a stunning cricketer he was to watch. And I think there is this distinction clearly between him as a performer and him as a holder of, you know, good statistics. However, there is clearly this accusation on him of he played this, particularly with bats, this kind of version of all-out aggressive cricket. And it was clear that, for example, someone like Don Bradman respected him as a kind of an entertainer and as a shot maker, but didn't seem to truly respect him as a batsman because of that reluctance to knuckle down. There was also, I thought, this rather sad patch towards the end of his career where some of the younger West Indians who he played with were unimpressed with the way he would get himself out, you know, and he would not, we always talk about the importance of, you know, playing a situation. He refused to do that. And actually, for maybe some of the younger cricketers coming through who were perhaps a bit more savvy, a bit more just desperate to win, they found that there was something a bit naive in that. It was also extraordinary how often in this book his entertainment comes through fielding. You know, if we think about like the great cricketers, we always think of watching them either in full flow with bat or ball, but this is someone who appeared to be able to get a crowd on his feet in the field. I mean, at one point,
the panther, that's what they called him, wasn't it?
Indeed, at one point Wisden is quoted and he backs up his own overthrow, so he throws the wicket down and then sprints around to back up the ball, which is quite a sight.
Look, that's a degree of energy that I certainly don't have on the cricket pitch. Obviously, one of the kind of narrative threads through the book is actually looking at the history of West Indian cricket, and the book starts off with probably quite laboriously working through some of the games that Constantine's father plays in, and then it looks at the kind of development of West Indian cricket through them. And one of the things that Pearson paints quite well is actually sort of the structural difficulties that there were in terms of getting the West Indies up and running as a test side. This amazing situation where, because you would travel around the various islands for a test series, that actually local selectors would pick the team in each island. So whilst they would all be under the banner of a West Indian team, you'd end up having, you know, only two players who played in all the games, and most of the players would be changed for the local boys each time.
Is a problem that for a long time has haunted the game. I mean, this went on and on, didn't it? This idea that when a team played in a certain island, that they would expect to have the local lads involved, was something that haunted the West Indian game for ages.
Mm-mm. And then going back to this question of Constantine's effectiveness, it is kind of an effectiveness as a figurehead, even if he's not necessarily turning games with bat or ball. And this 1935 series where the West Indies beat England for the first time in a series, and it's actually Constantine who's ends up captaining at the very end of that last, the white captain, because all of the captains of the West Indies in those days were, ends up being injured and not being able to finish the game, and it's Constantine who kind of brings it home. And I think one thing that is quite effectively and kind of poignantly painted here is that ability that he had to be a figurehead both within the game of cricket and then within the wider political world as well.
And I think this point about the rise of the West Indies is it's quite interesting instinctively making comparisons to how new teams go into Test cricket today. I was really surprised to discover that as a matter of course, England's early series against the West Indies involved 3-day Test matches, which is something now when we're having all these debates about, you know, would it be a massive problem to reduce Test matches to 4 days? It's interesting that at this point that flexibility was there. The book is also very good, I think, in showing that some of the glamour you would expect from international cricket tours was just not there for these pioneer West Indian teams. I thought it was quite a poignant story about the West Indian team making all these wonderful plans for when they would get to England and they would go and see shows in the West End, you know, they would be out in the dance halls and all this stuff. In reality, when they got there, they were being paid so little that they could do none of these things. And the weather was so awful and so foreign to them that they spent most of the time just trying to keep warm. And I think it was kind of a reminder that when you think of the wonderful circumstances for the most part that modern international teams are able to travel and operate in, some of these early pioneers for the game were, you know, they were poor travelling workmen to a considerable extent.
So that is Connie, The Marvellous Life of Leary Constantine by Harry Pearson. And that was the 103rd episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Please do jump onto Twitter and start a conversation about anything we've been talking about, or indeed anything else, really. And as ever, reviews left on iTunes are hugely appreciated and help to spread the word and get us out there to new listeners.